theguardian.co.uk.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
I love a good horror story, and I'm particularly keen on ghosts, which is just as well because this week's guests are here to talk all about them. Helen Dunmore is a poet and novelist, an Orange Prize-winning novelist, no less, whose last novel dealt with a very serious and sad period of Russian history. But she's back with a truly haunting ghost story, The Greatcoat. It's part of a series of horror books which has been produced in a new partnership between Hammer, that's Hammer as in Hammer Horror Films, and Random House. So to find out just what was going on and just how scared we should be, we've invited Hammer's chief executive, Simon Oakes, in to explain the series. But Helen, would you begin by reading us a little bit of The Greatcoat?
She had told her aunt that she wanted a large family. "It's what people seem to be doing these days," said Aunt Jean. "What do you mean?" "Well, the war," her aunt had explained briskly, as if it shouldn't need to be spelt out. "I only had Charlie. Your parents only had you. It wasn't uncommon at the time, but now it's to do with replacement, I suppose."
"Replacement?"
"It's a natural instinct," said her aunt. "I never thought of it like that," said Isabel. "I don't suppose you did." The word stayed in Isabel's head for weeks. Replacement. But the frightening thing was how easily the world got on without the dead. All those thousands, millions, yet somehow the houses were full of people just the same. The dead were gone. They were thought of, but the year rolled round and then there was another year and you couldn't live in the past. But the dead, of course, couldn't feel that, if they felt anything. They had missed so much. Years and years of life. How could they not feel resentment? The years that were rolling on were the very years that they were missing. They must want them back. No, she wouldn't think of that.
Helen, that is such an interesting passage because, and what was going through my head when you were reading it was the Siege of Leningrad, which of course is where you were last, and the enormous numbers of dead people that you dealt with in a very different context in those two novels.
Well, in this book, in The Greatcoat, it's a story where the past is very real and it imprints itself. It keeps coming forward, coming out of the shadows and printing itself onto the present. So we have this young man who's been involved in the bombing campaigns, and we have this young woman, she's newly married, she's in a new flat, and it's 1952. And the two should never meet, but they do meet. It's like a window opens in time and allows them to meet. And it begins with this knock on the glass in the middle of the night.
In a way, it is a historical novel as well, isn't it? Because it's set just after the Second World War. And it strikes me that a lot of ghost stories take this sort of this period feeling.
They do. I think you're absolutely right. And I took it because it's set in the year of my birth. I was born at the end of 52. So I feel I can just about remember the coldness of the bedrooms and the food being rather limited. You couldn't buy all the things we can buy today. The sense of a mixture of optimism and stoicism, I think, that people had at the very, very characterised that time. And trying to turn your back on the past, you know, that she's Isabel. We don't really know about her past, but she has a lot of things she wants to forget. And gradually through the novel, she can't forget them. So she's an ideal hauntee, really.
Her husband is a doctor, and I was quite interested in the fact that Sarah Waters' Little Stranger, the main character, is a doctor, and it's set in a sort of similar post-war period. I wonder whether there's something interesting going on there about the haunting of an old order and the coming of new orders.
Very possibly. I've written about the medical profession quite a lot. I find it very interesting, the whole idea of somebody who has this vocation. And her husband is very much a man with a vocation. He wants to provide and protect and build up the family. It's very, very post-war. But he's always absent. And in the absence, this flat kind of fills with absence and silence, and it becomes more and more creepy. And Isabel is more and more alone, really, and withdrawn. And she hears these footsteps overhead. And I think she's primed. She's almost ready to hear the sound of the other world.
You're writing about looking back to the Second World War, aren't you? So in a way, there is a huge weight of history bearing on this little chamber story set in an old creaky house.
It is. And the greatcoat itself symbolises that, because it is based on a memory of mine of sharing a bed with my sister, quite an old double bed with a lumpy ticking mattress. And on a cold winter's night, we would put on, over our bedclothes, my father's RAF greatcoat. And I remember exactly how it felt, and I remember the feel of it and the weight of it. And so, like a lot of my fiction, it begins with a real experience. And that was that very palpable thing which takes you into the other world. And without the greatcoat, Isabel would never encounter Alec.
Now, Simon, this is, in a way, is a classic horror trope, isn't it? An object that somehow becomes animated.
What I feel about ghost stories, actually, and about genre generally, is that you need to care about the people. And one of the things that we've always talked about is that the sort of films we make and the sort of work we get involved with has to be story-driven, and you have to have an emotional connection with the characters. I love Helen's writing generally, but what I love about this is the fact that it's a love story at the heart of it, actually. I mean, I have to say, I feel it's a love story masquerading as a ghost story, but I think you know what I mean.
Tell us a little bit about this project. Give us the backstory. I have got in front of me a whole rather wonderful, actually mouthwatering if you're into this sort of thing, collection of books, some of which are from films, which are novelisations of films, like The Witches, which is a novelisation of a 1960 film, The Devil's Own.
The reason we got involved with it was actually about creating ideas, intellectual property, if you like, for us for television and for film. And the most difficult thing that we find as film producers and financiers is finding great material. And what happens a lot with spec scripts in the genre is they tend to all be right now pretty much about body count and sort of blood and on whatever. And we always felt that with Hammer, it should be what we call elevated genre. It should be really story-driven. There should be, you know, very strong characterization, strong plotting and so forth. And one of the ideas that I had was to create a venture with Random House to actually basically create new underlying literature. Because Hammer did have a whole sort of history of making films based on classic literature. I mean, obviously the Dracula series and Frankenstein and so forth. It was sort of been forgotten because of the sort of slightly schlocky end to Hammer's film production in the 70s. Clearly, you always do novelizations anyway of films. So The Resident with Hilary Swank, that's the one that's just on your left-hand side. But the real important stuff is what we're sitting here talking about today, which is the new novels or novellas that we've been discussing. And also asking writers to take on maybe a genre that they haven't done before. And clearly, you know, the greatcoat was in the cupboard in your house mentally.
Was it something you'd written before, or was it written specifically?
No, I would say it was in the bottom drawer of my mind, probably.
Yeah.
And it is, what Simon said is absolutely true, that sometimes as a writer, being asked to do something can push you. It can push you to write things that you wouldn't have imagined writing yourself. I mean, the book exists because of the idea, would you like to write a ghost story? And it set off, it was like a fuse being lit and setting off all kind of things. And I remembered so many things that I wanted to go into the story.
Simon, this is the first of three this year, is it, you're doing?
Yes, well, the schedule is to have three new novels or short novels a year. And our intention, and of course this is not, by no means is it certain, but our intention and hope is that we'll be able to, you know, turn these wonderful books into film or television.
That was what I was going to ask you, because this is so filmic, isn't it, Helen?
I wrote this in a slightly different way, in the sense I did a very detailed outline. I did a lot of planning in my mind because of pace, suspense and so on. But character has to be at the core of it, because unless the reader is prepared to enter into that those characters and feel that shiver with them and have the, you know, have the dread, the anticipation, the grief, then it won't work. So it's got to be very fully realised.
And part of Isabel is that she's a young woman who's in the first years of marriage, and it's maybe a little bit disappointing to her. She hasn't yet had her children. Her husband is more absent than she might have imagined.
She doesn't know what she's supposed to be doing. I mean, she's in that era where women are being told, if you go back to the home, you'll be content and have children. It is the era of replacement. But she wants to do something, and she doesn't know what, and she doesn't feel that she belongs here. And we learn gradually that there are all kinds of fractures and deep chasms in her own past that she's completely trying to cover up, but she's not succeeding. They keep opening up. And that is part of the story. It's her past as well as her present.
I'd like to open up into a discussion of the novella, because you've both mentioned the novella word, and we've actually addressed this a little bit on the podcast in connection with Julian Barnes' Sense of an Ending, which won the Booker. What is a novella? What place does it occupy? Often we talk about genre in terms of novellas, don't we, rather than novels?
We do. And it's very much to do with length in my mind. I mean, I just see a novel as being 80 to 100,000 words. It's a very basic distinction that I make. I don't think of a novella as being different from a novel, except that it's shorter.
Yeah, and I think that we, from our point of view, in a sense, you know, we're a filmmaker, film producer, television producer, not a publisher. So to some extent, we took our lead from Random House. But generally speaking, I think that we understood the shorter novel suiting the genre very well. And historically, there had been, and we talked earlier this afternoon about Wilkie Collins, about Susan Hill, The Woman in Black, which we've just finished, is it just suits the genre for some reason, getting to the point quickly.
Well, Don't Look Now is another example,
yes,
isn't it?
Well, of course.
Novella. Yes, a lot of the classics are very...
Or The Turn of the Screw.
Or The Turn of the Screw.
Du Maurier, Patricia Highsmith.
Is this part of the big cultural shift? Do you think that this is that actually what we're seeing is you as a writer, Helen, filling the new spaces that are opening out? I noticed as well, I read a short that you wrote for the Penguin Shorts ebook series, which was another sort of rather haunting story.
I'm interested in doing new things, and I always have been. I began only writing poetry, and everybody told me I was a poet, and that was my identity. And when I began to write other to write short stories and so on, there seemed to be initially some resistance. It's like, oh, well, you're a poet and you're writing. But now I feel I will write, and if it works, it works. You know, if I've written a radio drama, I've written for children. And thinking about this, I was amazed by how many mainstream authors do have ghosts. Elizabeth Bowen mentioned Henry James, Emily Bronte, ghosts everywhere.
Everywhere, yeah.
Is there a difference, Simon, between ghosts and other forms of horror?
The lexicon of horror is huge. I mean, you know, I would say Jaws is a horror movie. It's a monster movie. There's monster movies, there's sci-fi, you know, there's vampires, there's Frankenstein, there's mythology, there's ghosts. I mean, there's so many different parts of it. And that's why I've always said that the, you know, what I call the sort of torture porn films of the moment, or have been the last 5 years, will probably fill a small little box on page 95 of the genre. I mean, it's huge.
Well, just one last thing that has struck me about this is I wonder to the extent to which there's a sort of retro urge in this, because this is very much a retro book in a way. Hammer is a retro concept, isn't it?
I mean, I don't see it that way, because it's living and breathing today. What we've done is we think it's a self-defining brand, if you like. It was in the vernacular. People use Hammer in the sort of vernacular in this country, and that gives it a tremendous strength, I think. And therefore, as a film producer and financier, you know, sort of part of your job is already made, because you say Hammer is going to, you know, publish and produce a film of Helen Dunwell's The Great Coat, which is a ghost story. It doesn't take much to work out that makes sense, if you follow me.
I've loved writing the novella, and I think there's a very basic point about stories and structuring a story, and it's very challenging. It took me, in fact, as long to write as a novel, which sounds odd, but it did, because getting all the fit technically, getting it to really work, getting the two times to work together, getting the suspense to work, getting the supernatural and the natural to shift in and out of each other. It's very demanding, so it's not kind of an easy ride, but it's very exciting, it's very exhilarating.
During afternoon tea, there's a shift in the air. A bone-trembling chill that tells you she's there. There are those who believe the whole town is cursed, but the house in the marsh is by far the worst. What she wants is unknown, but she always comes back. The specter of darkness. The woman in black.
So that's the trailer from Hammer's latest film based on Susan Hill's The Woman in Black, starring the one and only Daniel Radcliffe. Which is better, the film or the book? Certainly one good thing about the film is that it will inspire a great many more people to read the book. Joining me now is our film critic, Peter Bradshaw.
Hello.
Peter, where do you stand on this film versus book business?
Well, I think that there are many more compelling ghost stories in literature and in the theatre than in the movies, I think. I mean, and here I must say I distinguish between the classic ghost story and horror as such, the explicit world of horror which seeks to make manifest the idea of fear and violence, pain and dismay, much more so than the classic English ghost story, which I find to be obviously a much more subtle and oblique genre. My own private theory is that there is something of ghostliness in every image and every human being showed up on screen. I'm very much reminded of it. There's a review by, of all people, Maxim Gorky, who in 1896 reviewed a film by the Lumiere brothers. He noticed how the street scene, he says, it is terrifying to see, but it is a movement of shadows, only of shadows, curses and ghosts, the evil spirits that have cast entire cities into eternal sleep. It's a kind of melancholy game that you can play with yourself watching an old black and white movie, is to realise that everybody you see on screen is dead, except for possibly the little kids and babies. And in a sense, it also applies to all films. Everybody on screen, even a modern film, in a way becomes a ghost. They exist in this sort of celluloid ectoplasm on screen. And I think that's part of the fascination of ghosts on film. I mean, there are lots of very famous ghosts on film. Some of the most famous, possibly non-scary ghosts. Ghost. Patrick Swayze's Ghost, but he's not sort of scary, woo, scary in the sense that The Woman in Black is scary. Or Ghostbusters, they're ghosts.
That relates quite interestingly to this whole issue of the greatcoat, which is that it seems to me that the ghost story is becoming a historical genre almost. And maybe that relates interestingly to your idea of the ghost version of the ghost, if you see what I mean.
Yes, I'm very heartened. I'd like to see the ghost story, the old-fashioned, what I think of as it were, the sort of M.R. James, Henry James ghost story, make a reappearance in the movies. The classic version is Jack Clayton's The Innocents in 1960, his version of Henry James's The Turn of the Screw, a rather good version. Then there was, in this tradition, there was Alejandro Amenábar's film The Others in 2001, which was a Jamesian ghost story. Again, very good, with a twist. And then, of course, another excellent ghost story, I think, is M. Night Shyamalan's The Sixth Sense, which has what I think is still, for me, one of the scariest appearances of any ghost. And I still get a frisson when I see it on late-night TV, is when the little kid, played by Haley Joel Osment, who can famously see dead people, is alone in his house, and suddenly another kid appears in the doorway and says to him, "Come with me, I want to show you something." And it is really scary because, you know, he must be a ghost. He must be dead. So what on earth is he going to show him? And then the ghostly boy turns his back on Haley and you realise what's happened.
This business of the materiality of the ghost story.
Yes.
It seems to me that there is a trope. It does pre-exist films, but it has become bigger with within ghost stories, within films, of the object that becomes ghostly. Now, in Women in Black, you've got the terrifying automata, these sort of clowns and monkeys, which begin to suddenly move without anybody obviously there. I took my son to see a preview screening, and he turned around to me at one point and said, "Why are all these people leaping out of their seats and then roaring with laughter?" And I thought about it for a bit, and I thought, it's because they know they've been had.
Yes.
Because it is a cliche, and yet they have still been had. And I think how does that relate between books and films?
I don't know. Clichés are terribly powerful. They have what Noel Coward called the potency of cheap music. Clowns are scary. Dolls, Victorian dolls, the sightless staring eyes of Victorian dolls are another big cliche which knows it's a cliche and you think, this doll is going to be scary. I'm supposed to be scared and I'm too ironic and super cool and sophisticated to be scared and yet, hang on, I really am scared after all. They are the malign inanimate objects. Which, again, you're absolutely right. It is something which is one of the oldest tropes in M.R. James's Casting the Runes, this inanimate piece of paper. It's in your hands now. It means you're going to die unless you pass it on. There's something weird and atavistic and fetishistic about endowing something inert with a malign significance.
One of the interesting things about The Woman in Black was I thought, having been an aficionado of the stage show, which I took my children to see
right.
several times...
Yes.
The film version really brings out the theme of dead children in a way that the stage show didn't, because it has a lot of dead children in it, apart from anything
yes.
else. I wonder whether there is a way in which, in this particular arena, films can amplify what's in the written text.
Yes, the idea of dead children, again, the poignancy and pathos of a dead child can somehow be alchemised on screen into something else. So it's not just sad, you're scared at the same time. And possibly the most famous example of that is the quasi-ghost story of Don't Look Now, which, of course, famously begins with the married couple Donald Sutherland and Julie Christie, and their child dies in a horrible accident while wearing a red Mac. And then when they go on what they hope will be a remedial and redemptive trip to Venice, they see a sinister figure, tiny figure, wearing what appears to be a red Mac. And that image is at once suffused with tragedy and yet sinister and malign as well, because you don't know exactly what is happening. Is it the ghost of the girl come back? She can't have come back with any good intent, because the whole thing just seems so scary. And somehow there is something about the visual spectacle of the movies which assists this alchemy.
So I was very surprised to see how small Don't Look Now is as a novella. It's been just been republished in a collection of weird
don't,
stories.
I'm not even sure if it counts as a novella, really. I think it's just a longish short story. I mean, when I read it was in a collection by Daphne du Maurier, and it's only, I think, only about 40 pages or so, something like that.
And which is another interesting thing about these, particularly the spooky stories that tend to get made into films. We
yes.
touched on it with Helen and Simon. They tend to come from novellas rather than fully blown novels.
Yes, because some of the best adaptations can be, because you can open out, it gives the filmmaker a lot of license to open out. One of the most famous scenes in Don't Look Now was the lovemaking scene where they have sex, interspersed with flash-forward cuts to them getting dressed afterwards, which was rightly held to be a very ingenious innovation, but nothing like that exists in Daphne du Maurier. It is literally interspersed between two sentences in the original short story. They go to bed, they have sex, they get up and go out for the evening.
There's another issue that struck me in particular relation to The Greatcoat, which is it's a Second World War story. It's actually set after the Second World War, but The Greatcoat belongs to an airman who dies in the Second World War. And there is that does relate to a film tradition of
yes.
the Second World War. So.
Well, yes, I mean, the I guess the obvious one, is A Matter of Life and Death by Michael Powell and Emmerich Pressburger. It's what I think of as the kind of benign ghost tradition, really. It's not a scary movie, but these are ghosts. And it's one of the very few kind of ghostly stories which tries to imagine the afterlife, albeit in a tongue-in-cheek way, but is one of the very rare non-earthbound ghost stories which try to imagine that place from which the ghosts have come, or that place from which they are disbarred, the afterlife, heaven, what on earth, as it were, heaven can look like. It's a film which imagines death in wartime in possibly a rather sentimental way, as it's not riven with fear and horror in the way in which a story like The Greatcoat may be.
So it's not actually horrific, but
no.
It's what's interesting about The Greatcoat is it's a cross-haunting. It's the present haunted by the past and the past haunted by the
right,
present.
Right,
yeah.
This is a very different sort of thing. I mean, the ghost... It's a very gentle film. It's a wonderful film, but its purpose is not to be scary.
Now, what do you think about this business about a novel being commissioned by a film company which will be made into a film? Is that the right way round, or is that all sort of asked about elbow?
Not at all. It's been done many times. People forget now. The Godfather was commissioned like that. The Godfather was produced as a movie, and they brought in Mario Puzo to write the book before the movie. I mean, it was commissioned and envisaged as a movie. Then it was brought, and the author was commissioned to write the novel with a view to bringing in the movie. So it's not a massively new thing by any means. But I think a bit of cross-fertilisation is great. More power to the Robo Hammer are doing this. I mean, they were once a great power in the land, a kind of powerhouse of British film industry. And if they can cross-fertilise it with the world of literature, that's great.
Now, moving a bit more generally, we've just seen the Oscar nominations. There are a huge number of adapted books in it. So this relationship between film and book seems, is it increasing or has it always been like this?
I think it's always been like this. It's one of the things which exasperates some people, that producers want to see a proven track record of success. They think to themselves, right, here is a book, here is a best-selling book. It has sold, it has shifted units, it has shifted 1.76 million units. Now, if even a fraction of these people can be persuaded to go to the cinema or, more pertinently, at some stage, buy the DVD or get the download, then you have got a commercial proposition on your hands. And that's why books are a good testing ground, is because they show the track record. And it possibly is a lack of imagination in going for book adaptations and not making more of an investment in original screenplay and original creativity. But that's how it works. That's why it is. It's commerce. God.
But now their cries give me strength. Beauty is my power.
Consume her heart and you shall live forever.
Daddy. Somehow, this seems a fitting subject as we barricade ourselves against the sudden freeze that is going to be whooshing more and more intensely across the UK this weekend. And guess what? Susan Hill is going to be talking to John Mullen about The Woman in Black at our next Guardian Review book club. It'll be at the British Library here in London on Monday the 21st of February, just behind King's Cross Station. You can get tickets from our website at guardian.co.uk/books. And while you're there, if you haven't already, why don't you subscribe to our podcast? Then you can pick up all sorts of extra things like Susan Hill's book club, as well as the weekly books podcast. But for now, I'm joined by Lindsay Irving of the Guardian Books team, who's going to tell us about everything we have coming up in the coming week.
Yes, in Guardian Review on Saturday, the novelist William Boyd investigates how the modern world was created by the writers, artists and musicians who haunted Vienna in the first 14 years of the 20th century. And zooming rather further back, we finally arrive at the 200th birthday of Charles Dickens. We've been in the bicentenary for a while. Next week is the actual birthday. And why not celebrate by downloading one of our three Dickens audio tours? They will lead you in the footsteps of Oliver Twist, David Copperfield, or Pip in Great Expectations. And next week, we'll also be heading off for Portsmouth, where Dickens was born. Also this weekend, it's National Libraries Day, and we'll be publishing our chart of the top 100 most borrowed books. Julian Barnes will be writing about libraries in Saturday Review as well, and we'll also be finding out how the local library campaigns around the country are going. And if there's anything you can tell us about that from things you've been doing locally, please do.
And that's all from us this week. Thanks to Helen Dunmore, Simon Oakes, Peter Bradshaw and Lindsay. From me, Claire Armistead, and our producer, Tim Mabey. Woo!
Be afraid.
Great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.